Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Forged in Fire, where we explore how LGBTQ+ leaders develop their leadership superpowers. You'll hear from guests as they share how they navigated their journey through adverse and crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram. I'm an astronautical engineer in the United States Space Force and one of the senior transgender officers in the military. I'm a passionate advocate for the value inclusion brings to organizations.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to another episode of Forged in Fire. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by Vic Basile. Vic has enjoyed the rare opportunity of a career in public service and a social justice advocacy. A widely recognized national leader in LGBTQ community, he has committed his efforts to guaranteeing equality for this constituency. His initial work as a VISTA volunteer, which I had to look up to realize is a volunteer in service to America, as a community organizer there in the rural South, set him on a course of public service and advocacy. During the Obama administration, he served as the senior counselor to the director of the United States Office of Personnel Management. In that role, he was the director's principal lead on all LGBTQ issues affecting the civil service. Throughout the 1970s and early 80s, he held positions at ACTION, the former umbrella agency for the Peace Corps and VISTA. While there, he became a labor activist on behalf of federal employees. Vic is the author of the new book, Bending Toward Justice, a memoir of two decades of LGBT leadership and the founding of the Human Rights Campaign. Vic, we're so thankful you could join us. Welcome to Forged in Fire.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Vic, you're our guest for a number of reasons, including the release of your new book, but also as the first executive director of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, which later became the Human Rights Campaign. You have been there for a whole lot that has melded the LGBTQ advocacy community into what it is today. We want to find out how you became the leader that you are and that you were at that time, and then what skills you developed through the course of your life. I wanted to start by going back to your coming out experience, because in your book, you talk a lot about how AIDS pulled people out of the closet in the 1980s. And there was so much there that encouraged people to come out for reasons that weren't ideal. But for you, you came out before that AIDS crisis and said you blew the doors off when you did so. What was that experience like, and what led you to coming out and becoming an out advocate?
Well, a couple of things. As you mentioned, I was a labor activist as president of the staff union at ACTION. And at one point, we had a call from a trainer in our Chicago regional office who was beginning to transition. This is 1979, so very, very early in the movement. And it was a liberal agency, and so the management and colleagues were fairly supportive until it came time for the employee to start using the women's restroom. And then the women went crazy, and they decided the only way to resolve this is to fire the trainer. As a temporary employee, she wasn't entitled to union representation, but we were a fairly rebellious little group and decided that we were going to represent her anyway. And we started to grieve the whole grievance process, which had several levels to it. And we kept losing at all of the lower levels because basically we weren't entitled to represent her. The final deciding official was none other than John Lewis before he was in Congress. And he was head of all domestic operations at ACTION and a Carter appointee. I remember writing him a letter making all the parallels to the civil rights movement and asking for a meeting, which he granted. When I got to the meeting, and before I even sat down, he said, "Vic, I've read your letter. You're absolutely right. This was wrong, and we're rehiring the employee." And I figured that if he could do that, I should have the courage to be more open about who I was. It was quite a lesson for me in moral courage. And I thought that John Lewis was just incapable of doing anything morally wrong.
So how did that lead to your coming out event? And what was it like? What was coming out in 1979, both to yourself and to the world?
Well, it was a tremendously liberating experience, I have to say. It was because coming out freed me to be who I am, and I no longer had to worry about being found out. And it allowed me to use more effectively whatever leadership qualities that I had.
What was it about having this happen at that stage in your life and the work that you were doing at the time and then subsequent to that? How did the coming out experience augment what you were then able to do as a leader, or what skills were developed as a result of going through that process?
Well, I don't know that I developed any additional skills, but I do think that it, first of all, when I was closeted, I didn't really have a complete understanding of who I was, other than to say I was bisexual. But I, at the time, that's as much as I admitted to myself. And so I always felt that even that was a secret I didn't want to share with anybody. And I think it affected my overall performance. You know, it was like this blanket that was covering what I was doing. So when I came out, I felt this liberation, and immediately started to get involved in local LGBTQ politics in Washington.
Between your personal experience and what you write in the book that said one issue that you accepted universally was the closet was the biggest enemy, and that invisibility was a huge challenge, but the coming out process drives positive impact. Were there other things you saw as people came out and or through your experience that, you know, the authenticity of being out enabled?
Sure. There is that expression that I think everybody in the community knows now, is that to know us is to love us. And what I began to see as people came out was hearts and minds beginning to change. And that was a big deal, because, you know, as devoted as I am to our political organizations and the other institutions we have in the community, I don't think there's anything more powerful in changing hearts and minds than the simple act of coming out. It made a huge difference. I mean, it made it on Capitol Hill. It made the more people were out, the easier it was to talk to members of Congress about this issue, and the less afraid they were of being identified with it.
So speaking of having those conversations, you talked a fair amount in your book about vision and the importance of that and what was needed to give the community a better future. And it has been said of you that you had an optimism that was infectious and you were able to engage people and persuade them to do things they probably never thought they would do. How did you go about doing that, and what was important about sharing that vision?
Well, whoever said that about me was very kind. I do seem to have the ability to convince people to do things that they might not otherwise have thought that they were capable of or that they even wanted to do. It's a gift, I guess, that I have, and which has served me very well over the many years I've been doing this now. I don't know how it actually played out. I mean, I have, well, there was some examples. Is I had to recruit a board of directors for the Human Rights Campaign, and I needed people who could raise money, because the Human Rights Campaign Fund, as it was then called, was simply a political action committee, and the sole purpose of a political action committee is to raise money. And so that was the primary mission, is that we could support candidates for Congress who were supportive of our issues. And as you probably know, fundraising is not the favorite activity of many people, most people, I'd say. But it was vital to the success of the organization. So recruiting people who had the capacity to do that, even though they really hadn't a lot of experience in it, but they were connected enough, and sometimes they were people with a lot of money, because people with a lot of money tend to travel together. And so talking them into joining the board, knowing that they would have to fundraise, was a challenge, but we ended up doing it. I think because these individuals wanted to be part of something bigger.
So that sense of being part of something bigger and then actually making change is critically important. And I think there are two quotes from the book that I'm going to read that speak to your sense of pragmatism. Because you said that pragmatic politics is a methodical practice that demands patience and a willingness to accept incremental victories. You also said that lobbying is effective, but it doesn't get the headlines like street activism does or fire up your adrenaline. Yet it's that working within the system that gets results in a way that other forms of activism might not. How did that sense of pragmatism develop in you? And why does that become so important to actually getting things done?
Well, it was a process, because I started out as a street activist. I remember my first demonstration was coming to Washington in 1969 for an anti-war mobilization march. And I was incredibly energized by it. But, you know, as I look back on it, I don't think that it really did a lot to change the dynamic. Because what does is I discovered as I went along with it in the role at HRCF was that good old fashioned lobbying combined with constituent pressure and money are what speak to members of Congress and all elected officials at every level. And as Barney Frank once said about street demonstrations, he said, you know, if they're not combined with lobbying, the only thing you're putting pressure on is the grass. The quotable Barney Frank. but I think that it's true. I mean, what happens with a lot of demonstrations is that people will come to Washington and they'll march and demonstrate and then go home and not pay a visit to their member of Congress, which is, I mean, that's what they listen to. That's what all elected officials listen to, is what their constituents really have to say. And that was a hard lesson for me as a street activist, that was a hard lesson for me to learn. But it was important, and it paid dividends.
Can you expand a little bit about making incremental victories as part of the pragmatism? Because so many people want to go for that revolutionary change, which can be incredibly hard to get if you're looking for it in one bite. But if you tackle that in evolutionary steps, you can probably get there eventually. How did that factor into the work that you did leading the organization and supporting candidates?
Well, you're right in that the natural inclination is to want it all right now. And if you look at any movement, if you take the Black Civil Rights Movement, for instance, nothing was all right now. You know, it started with pretty small victories, and then you get Brown versus the Board of Education, and then you get the landmark Civil Rights Bill, and then the Voting Rights Act, and still African Americans have not achieved equality after all of these years. And I think with us, we started with Bella Abzug, for instance, introduced the first, what was then called the Gay Rights Bill in Congress in 1975 with a handful of co-sponsors. While that bill never got to a hearing, you gradually added more co-sponsors to it. And the goal was when you get enough, you can actually hold a hearing. And then you could, with a little bit of luck, you could actually get a vote on the bill. But that was a major step just to have a bill introduced. And then you had it introduced in the Senate a little later. And that just, anything that brought recognition to this movement was a good thing. And then when AIDS came along and the Reagan administration refused to do anything about it, we went to Congress and, in fact, proposed $0 for funding for AIDS until 1987. We went to the Congress to put money in the bill, and it was that quiet lobbying work that helped to secure those funds. And gradually, every year, there'd be more of an appropriation for AIDS research, treatment, and education.
You mentioned not only the importance of lobbying, but the importance of politicians hearing from their constituents and being swayed by the arguments that were coming from those folks. How did you get people to understand the need, whether it was you directly lobbying or whether it was helping the constituents understand so that they were, in fact, then motivated to go bring that desire for change to their elected officials and push for the change?
One of the other things I discovered is just making an argument and explaining an issue to an elected official doesn't get you a whole lot. They don't do anything because it's the right thing. Well, some do. I shouldn't be too down on elected officials, but some will respond to something like John Lewis, for instance, would respond to something because it was the right thing to do. But most elected officials will respond when they hear from their constituents back home and they know that this is an important issue. And when you can give them a campaign contribution, that's when they respond. As much as I'd like to think it was the other way around, I'm cynical enough to believe that it just doesn't work that way.
So beyond money, how did you make the connection with elected officials who had historically always othered LGBTQ folks? You know, they were scary, they were different. What tactics did you use to make those human connections that the challenges faced by LGBTQ folks are the same as those faced by everyone in the vast majority of circumstances? What are those things you did to humanize and put a face on LGBTQ people?
Well, one is in my own network of friends and colleagues was to be both out and to make it uncomfortable for them to not be more supportive. I mean, some of the natural allies, or at least I thought were natural allies, were the other progressive organizations. And while some of them were quietly supportive, many were afraid that the gay issue, quote unquote, was going to hurt their organizations, and so they tended to keep their distance. So I think making it uncomfortable for them to do that was part of what is part of the strategy that helped out. And I think that the more you could get people back home to write those letters or pay visits or make phone calls to their elected officials, the more success we had.
Yeah, just proving we exist and being there in front of people is such a valuable tool.
Well, you had some members of Congress who would say, I don't have any gay people in my district. And in fact, there was a congressman from Columbus, Ohio, who said that, actually. And Columbus has a huge gay community, a very active and organized gay community. But he actually thought that there were no gay people in his district. And so demonstrating that he was wrong. I mean, the more it still gets back to visibility. The more visible we are, the more progress we can make.
When you faced those kinds of comments or certain kinds of denials or biases that made it very difficult to get the message across, how did you navigate that? How did you, you know, maintain the persistence and the energy? I think the title of your book gets at this a little bit, that it's a very, very long, slow process. And so what did you personally do to keep up that energy and motivation to keep going, even in the face of those kinds of challenges?
Well, for me, just having that job was one of the most exciting things opportunities and things that's happened to me in my life. Every day I looked forward to coming in and continuing the fight. I am by nature a little combative. So I've never shied away from a good fight. But I do think that when you're really in a job you love, it wasn't terribly hard. And when you have people around you who are excited, and I mean, the energy that was on the board was really very positive, and it was very helpful to me. And as the staff grew, the synergy among all of us was palpable. It was good. But I think at the end of the day, I always found the job to be exciting and rewarding. So it wasn't hard to keep up that energy.
Your book focuses a lot on the time in which you led the Human Rights Campaign Fund and really the AIDS epidemic. Now, there's an area in it that you talk about the fact that if there was any benefit to the epidemic, it was that the community learned how to build organizations to provide services. There's a natural tension between organizations providing direct services to people and then also doing that lobbying and advocacy work to change the government policies that created the problem in the first place or created that lack of services. How do you and other leaders navigate that tension and figure out who does what or how do we address the root cause versus addressing the symptoms?
Part of the challenge was to educate leaders of some of the service organizations that they, in fact, could legally lobby. Because a lot of them said, oh, we're a 501c3, we can't do that. But in fact, they can. They can't do a lot of it, but they can do some and be perfectly legal in doing that. So part of it was to educate them on being able to do it. I do think that one of the most powerful stories is how, in the face of the government doing nothing about AIDS, is that we learn to take care of our own. those organizations sprang up almost overnight and did an amazing job of taking care of people who were sick. I'd also like to acknowledge the role lesbians played in the AIDS epidemic. I mean, there's some pretty powerful stories about women who started to take care of gay men. And that was pretty remarkable. And I think that when I first started, there was a pretty strong division between the men and the women's community. And I think that did a lot of healing. I mean, the two communities began to understand each other, and I think gay men were extremely appreciative of the fact that lesbians had stepped up to the plate and were doing more than their fair share. So I think that had a healing effect on the divisions and brought us together.
You talked about those opportunities and the environmental drivers that helped the men and women come together within the community at that period of time. When you look at the community today, what kind of divides do you see that may still exist, and what opportunities do you see for different elements of the community to come together?
Well, today, we clearly have some divisions, but they aren't quite the same, I don't think, as they were. We have some racial divisions in the community. We have some class differences in the community. I mean, and you can see, HRC is a good example of that. I mean, when I was still there, because there was a perception that it was just rich white men who were actively involved in the organization, it began to be called the Human Rights Champagne Fund. So I think those divisions are there, but I don't think that they split along gender lines the way they did. And I think in addressing those, it's important that there's the kind of outreach that brings African Americans more into the organizations that we currently have, and appeals to people at all class levels, and so that we, I mean, as an example, even though HRC has a reputation of being rich white men, the majority of its funding comes from those $35 memberships that people make to the organization, and that story is probably not told very effectively, because I think it's just not breaking down that perception, and the fact that there's now African American lesbian at the top of the organization helps enormously in healing those divisions.
I want to go back a little bit, because you touched on the fact that a lot of your work at HRCF seemed to be about, you know, finding the right people and finding the right people that could do fundraising. Was that a skill you had built prior to joining the Human Rights Campaign Fund? Were you the captain of a lot of teams as a child, or something else where you had to build an organization? Or was that something you had to develop on the fly when you got the job?
I've joked before that I'm not sure why I got the job, because I didn't have any of those skills when I got it. I mean, other than the fact that I was an organizer, you know, I had learned to be a community organizer when I was in Vista. And when you're an organizer, you learn how to find leaders. So, and while I was working in low-income communities, the principles are the same for finding people. You know, I was looking for people who wanted to be involved nationally in the LGBTQ community, and I was looking particularly for people who could raise money and wanted to do that. So they weren't terribly hard to find. Convincing them to come on the board was a challenge a little bit, but and as for me, I learned how to raise money on the job, just as I learned lobbying on the job. You know, I came in with a street activist mentality, as I said earlier, and I guess I was smart enough to know that some things just get you so far, and I got tired of losing arguments, or you know, the battles, and looked for a way to win. And there was one volunteer we had who was a professional lobbyist and who had AIDS, and he started to volunteer with us so that we could get more money to fight AIDS. And he took me by the hand, actually, and taught me about how to effectively lobby. And that was how I got the on-the-job training on lobbying. And the fundraising, as I said, I learned from a couple of people who, in the same way the lobbyists taught me, that who were professional fundraisers.
So many lessons that you learned over the course of this work, and even some of the difficult lessons of those battles that were lost. And you've been able to capture that time period and some of the things that were learned in the movement in your book. Why was it that you wanted to write this book, and what was it that you hoped would be shared in terms of those lessons that people can read about and learn from today?
Well, first, I think it's a compelling story about how a kernel of an idea in one person's mind, that is Steve Endean, grew into the largest and most influential LGBTQ political organization in the country. And he did it with very precious few resources. So I think it's a story that I wanted to tell for quite a few years, and about 3 years ago decided to get serious about it. So anybody who knows me would probably tell you how much I talked about doing it before I got actually down to writing. The other reason is I wanted younger people to know what it was like during the AIDS epidemic, because I think a lot of younger people today just, you know, because there's medications now and don't know what it was like to see the Washington Blade full of obits, and essentially what a horrible time that was. And I thought it was important that they understood that. And I think I also wanted to get now this, I didn't have this in mind when I wrote the book because it preceded it, but I am hopeful that younger people will realize, in the face of all this homophobia and transphobia going on now, that this is not new, that we've been down this road before. I wanted them to know how homophobic times were not so many years ago. So those are the reasons that I did the book.
Speaking of what you see in the homophobia and transphobia that folks are facing today, there was a Washington Post article a while back that described you as believing that the current attacks on LGBTQ people are strategic. What is it that makes you say that?
I guess years of doing this and seeing politicians and I just, you know, I mean, some of whom would just say, I'm with you on this, but I can't be public about it. You know, they just were, and then they would, even people who were good friends, when a homophobic piece of legislation came up, they would feel compelled to vote for it. I don't know whether you remember Jesse Helms, but he used to, early in the AIDS epidemic, he would, whenever we got an appropriation for funding, he would move to attach an amendment to it that said essentially that no part of the funds could be used to promote or encourage homosexuality. And those amendments would pass overwhelmingly. I mean, our best friends were voting for them. And it wasn't until we got smarter and with the help of a couple of senators, actually like Ted Kennedy, and on the Republican side, a surprise supporter was Orrin Hatch, who a very conservative senator from Utah. And they comprised a way to beat Helms' amendment, and they did. That's when we started to make some progress, I think.
So one more question I have is that you've self-described as an introvert, and the positions you've taken are so public, so outward-facing, that require a lot of peopling in today's terms, and doing that work that puts you in front of others and maybe for many introverts drains your batteries. How did you push yourself into those roles that required you to do that type of interaction that may be so challenging for many introverts?
Well, let me put myself in define the introvert in a way, a division in my personality. I have no problem one-on-one with people. As I said earlier, I have a lot of luck talking people into doing things that they never thought they were going to do before. But it's the public role that I find very disconcerting for me. I might still be at HRC had it not been for the public role that was demanded of that position now. I mean, I when I started, the press didn't want to talk to you at all. And now you hardly pick up the newspaper anymore and not see some story about LGBTQ in it. Or turn on the TV and watch a program that doesn't have LGBTQ characters. And it's a totally different world. And I, even in deciding to do this interview, I don't want to be too candid, I guess, but it's difficult for me. I just don't like the public spotlight. I'm just not comfortable in it.
Well, it's clear that one thing you are doing is sharing the lessons with other leaders and others who can take up the public aspects of the long fight. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, you have that little bit of combativeness and that the job was rewarding enough that it kept you energized and it kept you going during that long haul. And you said in your book that when you yourself would get into the doldrums, what would keep you out of that is remembering that, you know, Stephen Dean was committed to the long haul and that the fight would take years, even decades. And that was just the way it was going to be. So what advice would you give to other leaders or anyone else who wants to be an advocate or an ally in this movement, for the type of long fight? What's going to keep them engaged?
Well, good question. I'm hopeful that it's some of the same things that kept me and other leaders engaged back in the 80s and the 90s. I think it's particularly important now because of the times we're in and how many pieces of legislation are being passed now that are geared mostly towards the trans community, but also the larger LGBTQ community. And we have a long road ahead of us. So I think that leaders today need to look back at the history a little bit, that we had to learn how to fight and to win, and we did. And we will do that again. I don't know how much time it'll take, but I do think that, I guess I'm still optimistic enough to think that we're going to overcome these hurdles now. And when we convince political leaders that there's no more or little to be gained anymore by their homophobia and their transphobia, that they'll drop all this stuff. Because I just don't believe that on a personal level they believe what they're doing. It's just for political gain.
I think that's a great point to close on that ties together so many of the things you've talked about visibility being such a positive driver of change. And now with 20% of Gen Z folks being out and identifying as LGBTQ, that helps drive away so much of the fear. And what you talked about in your book, Bending Toward Justice, about building organizations, remembering our history, understanding how we get there, that is absolutely crucial to bringing all these elements together and keeping this long fight going towards, you know, everyone having the opportunity to flourish in life. So, Vic, thank you for what you've done for the community over a long career of public service, and thank you for appearing on our show and sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm very appreciative. It's been enjoyable, even for the introvert.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
All right. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Forged in Fire is hosted by Bree Fram and Liz Cavallaro. Produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos and Christina George. Guest management by Trey Wirth and original music by Bridget Benemark. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. To learn more about Forged in Fire, please visit us at forgedinfire.org.